Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
Bond's birthday project, the most brilliant idea of the year, or a digital fail?
Hi guys, it's Rachel Taylor here. I have joined in the birthday project at wearebonds.com.au.
The breakfast battle is now a three-way.
Stupid ads, stupider people. Beers and snacks, all
after dark. NAB on the attack again.
Oh no, no, look, I'm not saying we only offer that to new customers. What I'm saying is that we don't offer it to existing customers.
Plus, as you can hear, we welcome a new theme tune. Thank you, Noise International. Now, as well as a new theme tune, with us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is a new member of staff, friend of the podcast Kathy McGinn, previously strategy director at Mindshare, joined the Mumbrella team on Monday. Kathy, welcome back to the podcast. Let's start with your most recent gig, Mindshare. It was your first time at a major media agency. Is there anything about doing that sort of role that you don't really guess until you're actually doing it?
I think I was surprised at quite how much gravy there is flowing through the offices. There's obviously this competitive market, and there's an amazing amount of publishers courting media agencies, and the perks really are quite lovely.
So this is the idea that, you know, as a media agency, you're deciding where your client spend is going, and there are a lot of different places it can go, and some of that spend is kind of top of mind. It's, you know, you might give it to one radio network or another or a specific program, so they will do anything to remind you as a media agency person that they exist.
Well, of course, I'm not implying that that is the what makes the ultimate decision.
But that's why they do it, though. That's the motivation. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts.
Oh, I thought they were. I thought it was pure, delicious altruism. No, I mean, I think very much in terms of strategic decisions, that's not how they're influenced. But I guess when you're choosing between one outdoor company and another, there's certainly a bit of influence going on.
I mean, it is an interesting debate. I mean, I wrote about it. I remember going to Cannes and seeing all of the, you know, the media agency bosses all out there, all hosted by a particular TV network. Most of them had sort of flown out via a nice stay at, if I remember rightly, it was the Armani Hotel in Dubai. They put them up on for a few days on the way out. And I kind of was a little bit uncomfortable that maybe it goes too far. I mean, do you think there's the gravy, there is too much gravy?
I think perhaps the real glory days are over. And certainly all of the WPP agencies have a very, very strict code of conduct around what they may or may not accept.
And what other kind of other impressions of working media side?
I guess it's it was a surprise to me quite how complex the business of trading actually is. I think, not to insult the business of media agencies, but I hadn't expected it would be such a kind of delicate balance and such a long process.
Well, let's get your social media creds out of the way. You were previously involved in Social Media Club Sydney, you involved Digital Citizens, you spend a lot of time on social media. Why? What do you get out of it?
I think it's a really extraordinary way of connecting with people that you wouldn't otherwise come into contact with. I like the fact that the geographical boundaries are removed. You can interact with people regardless of where they are on the planet.
Is that because partly you are living on the other side of the globe? Do you think your interest would be as piqued if you lived
Side from where?
Well, sorry, yes, but if you haven't picked up, maybe Kathy's not Australian birth.
But coming from an Australian, that's a very defeatist attitude.
It's a hard question to answer, because I think when I moved here quite a long time ago, there really wasn't very much in the way of social media, so I don't know if I lived in London still if I would be hanging out on Facebook quite so much. It's a great way of keeping in touch with my friends and family.
You'd sure. Still be using Hotmail and Bebo, maybe.
I'm still using Bebo. That's never going to die. I think that's one way of looking at it. But then also I think that the fact is, professionally, social media's had a huge impact on the way that I work and the marketing you know, the business of marketing has changed so much as a result.
Which platforms, which social media platforms are kind of interesting you at the moment?
I'm still loyal to Google Plus. I think it's not really reached its potential, but I think it's probably going to get there. I'm really liking Pinterest.
Now, Pinterest, we've touched on a little bit on last week's podcast, but what are you getting out of Pinterest?
It's just a nice visual way of quickly curating and sharing images, predominantly images. I like Tumblr as well, but I think that community can be quite niche, whereas Pinterest has broader appeal.
Now, Tumblr, again, it's a way of sharing content. I'm trying to think of a good way of describing it without using the word curating, because I hate the word curating as a slightly wanky word.
It seems like just a short form blog for images, is that right? And how does that then, other than the fact that you're sharing it with the world, how is that a social media? And how does Pinterest differ from Tumblr?
So Pinterest is pretty much entirely images, whereas Tumblr can be... I actually engage quite a lot with the poetry community on Tumblr, as pretentious and awful as that sounds. I think that they're very much specific small communities around very particular areas of interest, which I think is fascinating. And you can, the social aspect comes from the sharing. So that the more shares, the more kind of successful a post is, and you get a really good sense of what people are interested in and what is genuinely shareable content.
Now, we talked about, I mentioned briefly, Digital Citizens. It's worth maybe just explaining what that organisation is and what its remit is.
So I guess we founded it because we thought that there was a need in Sydney for a space for debate around the way that the social web and the digital, I suppose, revolution has changed people's lives in a number of different ways. So it debates issues around politics, privacy, I suppose the way that people's work practices are changing as a result. It's a usually bi-monthly event that we hold in Sydney CBD. We're actually running a bit of a feedback session at the moment, so we're really hoping the community will give us some guidance around what they want to see.
And how are you gathering the feedback?
So if you go to digital-citizens.org, there's a questionnaire online.
And what sort of questions are you asking?
Just really... if there's any particular speaker or area of interest that people would like us to facilitate.
And one of the things I've been interested in is, despite the fact that social media seems to attract a lot of marketing types, you've been trying quite hard with Digital Citizens to make it beyond just social media and marketing.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise it's a bit of a busman's holiday for me personally. I think as well, there's, you know, it's had such wide-reaching implications for people. So in terms of, you know, how you educate your kids, for example, or... what the way the music industry is developing as a result.
So that was your last Digital Citizen section, was the
exactly.
music one.
Which was, I think, really interesting. We had a musician talking about how they had become self-funded without needing to use a label. We also had the president of the ARIA Awards talking about how they were using Twitter and social to share their message.
You mentioned the rules and controls within and privacy sort of thing. Google has just come out this morning and said that they were changing the way search was going to be done, getting rid of a lot of privacy settings. Is that correct? Can you explain a little more there? Or
all they've done really, it's not actually as profound a change as I think people fear it is. So it's always been the case that when you're logged into your Gmail account, then Google is collecting information about you, which it uses in search. What this change means is that they're sharing information across every single Google product that you might have an account with.
So whether you're on YouTube or Google, for instance, it will put both bits of information together and use it to serve more appropriate ads to you. Is that the thing?
Yeah, exactly. So that search becomes incredibly personal. Personalised, and all of your data is being used to give you, I mean, ideally, a more sort of useful and relevant experience.
This week, we at Mumbrella had a Managing Social Media Risk Masterclass, Kathy, that you presented various case studies of brands that found themselves in trouble. Talk us through a few of the examples that you focused on.
Well, my favourite is the Woody Harrelson promotion for his film Ramp Up.
I am utterly unfamiliar with this example.
So you're aware of a website called Reddit?
Well, fortunately, I think I was going to say you were aware of Woody Harrelson, but happily, I am aware of both Woody and Reddit. Yes.
So there's a feature on Reddit called Ask Me Anything, where often celebrities come on and sort of run the gauntlet of the Reddit community, which if you've ever spent any time on Reddit, you can tell is quite an irreverent and fairly controversial community. And so Woody Harrelson took part in this Ask Me Anything feature, which I think was the bright idea of perhaps the intern at his PR agency, and he refused to answer any questions other than ones about the film itself, which enraged the Reddit community so much that there have been various awful spin-off memes, and Woody Harrelson, search for Woody Harrelson in Google has sort of skyrocketed, and none of it good. And I think that Ramp Up as a film, its publicity has been really damaged by that, just by not knowing the audience.
Now, the masterclass was the idea around managing that social media risk. What are the kind of common mistakes we see brands making in social media?
Well, I think the Qantas example is a great one of simply ignoring not taking the temperature of the community before you go out with a marketing initiative. So that's a classic example.
For those who don't remember Qantas, Qantas luxury was the hashtag.
And it was co-opted and used. I think my favourite tweet was someone saying, I can't wait to see the air crash investigation about the social media disaster for Qantas.
And what they'd done was they'd originally asked people to share their experiences of Qantas luxury in order to win some first-class pyjamas, I think it was.
And this was the day after grounding the entire fleet. So sentiment wasn't positive to start with.
Next, Bond's birthday project. Campaign of the year or massive digital fail?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Microcitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week, apparel company Bonds launched new campaign The Birthday Project, as devised by Clemenger BBDO to acknowledge its 97th birthday. Actress Rachel Taylor explains.
Hi guys, it's Rachel Taylor here. I have joined in The Birthday Project at wearebonds.com.au. Basically, Bonds is looking for 35,301 Australians to represent each day that Bonds has been a part of our lives. So to join in, check out wearebonds.com.au.
The catch is no two people are allowed the same date. The ambitious project stretches across online, social media, outdoor, print and radio. Tim, you were quick to plug in your details for a free shirt, not suggesting you're thrifty, followed by an opinion piece touting it as the campaign of the year. Why will it be?
Because I got my free shirt. No, so the idea is, I suppose what makes this idea interesting is this idea of mass personalisation, or, you know, giving the public the feel of that. We saw it a bit with the Share a Coke project last year, where anyone could rush out and try and get the bottle with their first name on, or the idea was you got it for a friend and shared it with them. Although I sort of got the impression that mainly people were doing it about themselves, because there is that sort of egotism and in involved, I suppose. So this takes it to the next level. The idea that you go onto the website and you claim your date of birth from any day from all the years that that Bonds has been in existence, and then they'll send you, if you're the first to get there, then they'll send you a T-shirt, or they will the first 15,000 people anyway. So really great idea, because you can see how people will just engage to claim their date of birth. One of those ideas that has got so much PR possible to build around it, so you get famous Australians and their date of birth. And we saw that right from the start with a big photo of, kind of 10 or so famous Australians all photographed together with their dates of birth across their chest, including, as you say, Rachel Taylor, but also, Dame Edna and some of the kind of regular brand ambassadors, Jessica Watson, the young sailor, and so on. So really nice idea for a campaign, which I think, you know, as this week has been, you know, it launched halfway through the week, so we're only at the beginnings of it right now.
Cathy, you followed that piece of Tim's up with your own opinion about how it nearly became a social disaster. What happened?
And I don't think we're entirely out of the woods yet. While it's obviously a brilliant idea and highly engaging, it's almost been a victim of its own success in terms of the number of people trying to get onto the site, upload their images, which will obviously have to be moderated by hand to make sure that no one uploads obscene pictures. So I think what's happened is the site simply wasn't equipped to deal with the load. It's also not available as a mobile or tablet version, which means a lot of people, you know, that's how they interact most with social initiatives is whilst they're on the move.
Yeah, so one of the things was it was built in Flash, wasn't it, which is not supported by iPads and iPhones and that sort of thing, whereas people would sort of... I guess people, if it was a digital agency doing it, I suspect people would have probably argued build it in HTML5, which is a bit more... I'm using all of these really wanky words. I nearly said platform agnostic. But
good.
You know what I
more
mean.
Good, yeah. You could have used.
Well, but which it doesn't matter what device you're looking at it on. Then, you know, it would work the same. And then, of course, yeah, as you say, there was just the server load thing. But is it something that you can reasonably account for, the sheer level of traffic? You know, in your previous role as a marketer, I'm sure there are times when you've seen a sudden sort of spike of interest in a site that, you know, you're trying to draw an audience to. Can you plan for it?
Well, I think, I mean, I've actually had the exact same experience of managing a website that appeared on Today Tonight. And
as this one did, funnily enough.
Yeah, exactly. And the resulting spike in traffic meant the site fell over. I mean, we knew that the site was going to fall over, and we tried to take steps to preempt that. But, I mean, I think that they were experiencing, Bonds were experiencing 4,500 hits a minute at one point. So I think you can reasonably anticipate that if you're going to get coverage on one of the most watched shows in Australia, then a lot of people are going to follow that call to action.
And of course, what they hadn't seen was the report itself, which basically became a 4-minute call to action to go to the website, do it now before someone else gets your birthday. So you know, it was such good PR. That was the problem. It was such a direct sort of call to action. Again that afternoon, the image was on the front page of MX, again with the URL right there on the front page as well. So it was better than advertising. You know, almost by the time the advertising campaign kicked in, the PR had done such a good job around this idea that, you know, that the demand was there. And I must admit, I feel slightly on risky territory in that, you know, Mumbrella itself struggles when we send out our daily email, particularly if we've tweeted a good story at the same time. There's a sort of 15-minute period where we get server errors, and we've had 3 years to get it right. So so I kind of do feel some sympathy for them.
Yeah, but I mean, I think particularly with a campaign that has such a broad audience appeal as this, you might want to plan for that success rather than sort of mop up the mess afterwards.
Where to next for the campaign then?
I think there's a few things they can do. You know, the sort of obvious things are that they're gathering all these great pictures of ordinary Australians. So you can sort of visualise, they can then do something with these images in future advertising campaigns, you know, gather things that unite them. The example I sort of wrote was, you know, get a picture of some of the redheads, and, you know, just then, rather than "we are Bonds, we are red" would be a, you know, great ad, and so on, you know, sort of. So that you can see there's lots more sort of just pointing to the things that say, here are lots of different but same ordinary Australians who all love this brand. So it feels like there's still some way to go with the campaign yet.
And where are Chesty Bonds?
Where are Chesty Bonds? Well, one of the interesting things about this campaign is that it's very much just about the Bonds brand at the brand level. So this is the first time they've ever done a major campaign which is just about the brand rather than a specific product. So obviously, you know, you'll see the, you know, the celebs happen to be wearing Bonds products in some of the photos, but it's not like, say, you know, the Christmas campaign with the 12 days, which was about, you know, 12 different products and so on, or most of their campaigns, which are, you know, really nice outdoor campaign for hoodies or something. So Chesty Bonds, don't give up on it. It's still around, and I noticed it has featured in the PR a little bit, at least in the newspaper coverage.
Next, The Week in TV.
on Monday, Ten officially launched its new show, Breakfast, despite actually launching last Thursday and Friday to catch the news of the Prime Ministerial Challenge. Now, Monday, the show took 56,000 viewers, which was about 7,000 up on Thursday's surprise launch, but it fell away to 37,000 on Tuesday, while Sunrise, to contrast it, over on Seven, took 10 times that, just over 370,000, with Today not far behind.
Tim, when you interviewed Magella Wemers, executive producer of the show, she said she couldn't go into the market third with exactly the same as what Sunrise and Today are offering. Do you think Breakfast has a big enough point of difference to the other two shows?
Well, it's certainly the only show where there's a big tray of apples inexplicably balanced just to the side of the producer's big red, the presenter's big red couch. So so that's one point of difference that I immediately saw. In terms of format, I suppose what they are is they're kind of looser. So they're, you know, they, if you were to watch Today or Sunrise, then pretty much at the same time every single day, the same type of segment happens. They're always very, very tight at, you know, hitting the news at the top of the hour, but also just the, you know, they'll always at the same time be on the couch, or they'll always at the same time be, you know, up on the more kind of formal desk with the newspapers in front of them or whatever. So it follows far more of a tight routine. And one of the things that Today did when Tom Malone came in as the producer was they tightened up around that, and that was when they started closing in on Sunrise. So we're seeing a more kind of, you know, loose approach, certainly at the moment with 10. So, for instance, they'll be chatting to a guest and it'll be time for the news bulletin. So they'll break away from the conversation, they'll have the news bulletin, then they'll come back and do the other half of the segment otherwise, you know, afterwards, which some of it could be about finding its feet. Some of it could be, you know, a little bit more deliberate. Of course, it's a new show with a new team, and clearly behind the scenes they're not necessarily that slick yet. So I don't think we're genuinely seeing all the points of difference. Other little things, like, you know, there's an audible tone that just sounds on the hour and the half hour, so it just plays in whether somebody's talking or whatever, which makes you jump a bit at first. But I suppose it's useful if you're getting ready for your breakfast or whatever. Probably worth the declaration of interest that I was involved as a pundit on a segment on the first day last week, so got to see a little bit of it behind the scenes as well. And the other point of difference will be Paul Henry, one of the four presenters, but the controversial Kiwi presenter. You know, he's clever and witty at times, but also kind of controversial, and has certainly been seen as being a little bit racist as well. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I've tuned in a couple of episodes, and I'm quite enjoying it, to the point of I don't think I'm tuning in just to see how it is. I'm actually tuning in because I want to watch it over the other two. Maybe I'm just adverse to many shades of orange and red, but I think that their whole set feels a little fresher. It's working on me.
Yeah, and it's interesting times because we've got, you know, Sunrise is celebrating its 10th anniversary this week, and they put together a really good sizzle reel, which you can see on the Mumbrella website as well, which just discovered on YouTube this week. But that's really strong. And the other thing about Breakfast is there's a massive attack by the editor of the Confidential section, but in the Daily Telegraph this week, really going after Today and claiming that it's just become very blokey, very testosterone, very laddie. And it's a real, you know, it's a really kind of strong attack. So I don't know what they've done to annoy the telly, but I get the feeling that they have.
So will it last is the question?
I think they recognise that it takes a really long time for something like that to bed in. They stuck with it for the project. They've sort of talked about, you know, I'm sure it won't, but it won't take that long. But they've talked about, you know, it taking 10 years to change breakfast habits. I think probably it will. It'll gradually crawl up towards 100,000. And then they're taking a slice. They'll probably take a slice of advertising revenue they weren't getting before. And that, you know, I would be amazed if in 10 years they're number one. But they'll probably be further ahead than they are now.
Yeah, Steve Allen of Fusion Strategy, in a summary of how Breakfast is doing this week, said that the incumbents are throwing everything they can to repel the startup, including cash giveaways. Do you think they feel threatened?
I would imagine they'd have been looking very, very carefully at the numbers for the first few days, and probably that feeling of threatenedness may have faded a little bit. You know, when the gap was so large. I mean, the really interesting thing it was going to be able to do was, you know, kind of it was never going to win. But if it takes more audience from 7 than 9, or vice versa, it might decide who wins. So, you know, it's got sort of like the role of a minority party when there's an election, when then there's a hung parliament. So they may actually get the casting vote in who wins the day. So that's going to be where it's interesting. But no, I think they're probably beginning to relax a little bit at the moment. Next, a pedo in Speedos.
The Ad Standards Bureau is in the unfortunate position of having to review pretty much every ad that gets complained about, no matter how ridiculous. This week, the ASB ruled on two such ads. The first was an ad by Euro RSCG for AeroGuard, set in a 70s caravan park to the tune of Summer Lovin' by Grease. Let's take a listen.
Need to rush.
Met some friends down at the park.
Beers and snacks all after dark.
Summer days drifted away
to oh, those summer nights.
Oh, well, oh, well, oh, well, oh.
The complaint to the ASB read, "One of the characters, a man wearing very, very brief red bathers, is wiggling his hips to the music, but very suggestively. Next to him is a young lad who is obviously looking pretty disgusted. The camera pans in on this man and the boy as the man turns and passes a plate of food to him. We always cringe when we see it. It is so suggestive and looks like the man is a pedophile trying to attract the boy." Kathy, you saw this ad. What are your thoughts?
I think this is very much a case of to the impure, all things are impure. I genuinely found that staggering, that read of it. It seemed clear to me that this guy is intended to be an embarrassing dad.
What if the man was an old woman? Is it just as offensive? I mean,
the guy's only about 40-something.
He's only 40-something. I think we're getting an insight, not so much into the complainant, but also Colin's mind. What are you thinking about an old woman? What in Speedos? Is this what you're saying?
I mean, it's not as offensive to me as Tony Abbott in Speedos, to be honest.
The second ad by Cummins Ross for Jeep featured a cross-dressing dog on a bed as a man wakes up. The complainant wrote, I always feel when we do these, I always feel like we need to get a pompous voice like they do in Media Watch.
We'll give it a go.
Okay. The complainant wrote, "I am disturbed that this appears to be a reference to bestiality in primetime TV hours. I find this totally tasteless and inappropriate. If there is some other way of interpreting this scene, I'd love to hear it."
That's a good voice.
Thank
you. That's a very good voice. It reminds me a little of, I'm pretty sure there was a Scottish character in Little Britain who had a slightly similar voice.
Tim, have you ever heard of an agency putting in a complaint on a rival agency just to stir trouble?
Do you know, I mean, I have, but not in this example. This one, I think, is you know, the genuinely perhaps slightly loopy. I mean, you know, a few people in the comment thread have sort of, you know, have made the point. Look, you know, yeah, the joke kind of is about, in the loosest terms, there's a nod towards the dog setting up the man to make it look like there was bestiality going on to get back with the man's girlfriend and get the boyfriend kicked out. You have to watch the ad to really understand that. But it's pretty harmless stuff that your kids are not going to come away from that ad having learned all about bestiality. So I suspect that in this case, no, it's not. It's not a rival agency. What you'll tend to get complaints from rival agencies, sort of, you know, apparently coming from a member of the public or whatever, is for instance a car ad that maybe, you know, skirted close to the rules over, you know, showing speed or that sort of thing, where they think there is a shot at causing them some trouble and actually having the ad banned. That I suspect would be when competitors might stir things up a little bit.
Next, NAB back again.
Uh-huh.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week saw the launch of yet another ad offensive for NAB by Clemenger BBDO Melbourne. Talking a lot about Clems and during this podcast. It carries the same tone as last year's award-winning breakup campaign and targets NAB's rivals, suggesting they won't change. Let's take a listen.
Could you just tell me, are you going to lower my home loan rate?
Oh, I can't see why not.
Great. Wait, so is that a yes?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Look, I'm not saying we only offer that to new customers. What I'm saying is that we don't offer it to existing customers.
My hands are tied. I'm bound hand and foot, actually.
That's a beautifully hidden fee.
We don't say hidden. It's hard to find.
Look, I understand what you're saying, but if you weren't meant to pay that fee, why have you been paying it for the last 2 years?
Well, you see, this is actually more of a question for middle management or upper middle management. See, I'm in lower middle management. You'd have to speak to either middle management or upper middle management.
Kathy, what are your thoughts?
Well, I suppose with my sort of social media obsessed hat on, the issue for me with this campaign is not only does it not feel quite as fresh as last year's breakup, but it's all well and good to talk about how bad the other banks are, but unless NAB can really demonstrate that they themselves are different in this regard, I think that what's going to happen is there'll be a backlash.
Now, I saw Adam Ferrier from Naked appearing on Ten's Breakfast, actually, the other day, and he talked about marketing being about a promise kept. And by the way, I do recommend the Adam Ferrier segment. If you can find it online, then do go to Ten's Breakfast website and watch it. It's worth a watch. Strongly recommend. But the point that Adam made was... marketing is about a promise kept, so you've got to make the promise and then you've got to keep it. And yeah, I suppose that's the NAB thing, isn't it? It's if there was a backlash about the whole we're all about being different to the other banks, is the point at which you're failing to actually convince the public of that is when it kind of becomes an issue.
Should Clems have known the public perception and taken a different route?
I suppose the question is, do Clems have the ability to influence the way that the bank operates, which I think would be the real win. But I guess arguably steering well clear from that whole subject might have been a bit of a better move.
Is the fly on the wall shtick wearing thin?
Do you know, I think it is a little bit. Oh, I'll tell you what I have a bit of a problem with is the... Cause this is sort of fake fly on the wall, you know. You feel like it's a hidden camera trick where they're secretly filming the bosses of the other banks. And there's a few people have been doing that, and they kind of played pranks on people, or apparently played pranks on people when they're being locked in, when it was all about locking you into your mortgages or whatever. But of course, they're all actors because, you know, ridiculously, it's illegal to imprison people in this country just for making just in order to make an ad, which is clearly a victory for the lowercase liberals. PC gone mad. But what it does mean is it starts feeling a bit inauthentic because you know, some of the early stuff was genuine hidden camera stuff. You know, when they were kind of dropping $10 on the street and filming people picking it up and rushing to give it back and that sort of thing. So yeah, I. There's just that authenticity thing that the hidden camera stuff that isn't real hidden camera stuff. I'm a bit over now. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Colin.
Thank you, Tim.
And thank you to Kathy.
Thank you kindly.
Well, we're doing our thank yous. Thank you again to Noise International. This theme tune you're hearing playing out in the background comes from them. The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.
The complainant wrote, "I am disturbed that this appears to be a reference to bestiality in primetime TV hours. I find this totally tasteful and inappropriate. If there is tasteless." Media Watch would never say tasteful. Should I start again? The complainant wrote,
Complainant.
The complainant wrote, "I am disturbed that this appears to be a reference to bestiality." We'll